right, well, we'll get started. Good afternoon and welcome to the Cato Institute's briefing on sea-launched nuclear cruise missiles, or SLCMN for short. Today we will examine the potential benefits as well as the opportunity costs of adding SLCMN to the U.S. nuclear arsenal. My name is Lawrence Montreal. I'm a Director of Government Affairs at the Cato Institute. Joined today...
Everybody back to the office.
Yeah. I'm sure that won't happen throughout the event. I'm joined today by our two primary discussants, Robert Sufer of the Atlantic Council, who make the case for adding SLCMN to the arsenal, and Eric Gomez of the Cato Institute, who contends that the opportunity costs are too high to justify allocating scarce resources to the program. So we'll begin with some opening remarks by each of our discussants for about 15 minutes each, and then we will open up the floor to discussion and questions for the audience. Before I get into the introductions, I do just want to give some baseline vocabulary and understanding of some of the discussions that we're going to have here today, specifically for those of you in the audience and who are watching online who may happen to might not be nuclear weapons experts. Firstly, it's important to understand the difference between tactical and strategic nuclear weapons. SLCMN is intended to be a low-yield or tactical nuclear weapon employed by surface vessels or attack submarines. Tactical nuclear weapons are typically used for specific gains on the battlefield, like targeting large formations of armor or infantry, as opposed to larger strategic nuclear weapons that may be employed to take out, say, an entire city. Another important thing to understand is the difference between a cruise and a ballistic missile. SLCMN, as you can guess by the name, is intended to be a cruise missile. Cruise missiles are propelled by jet engines, much like aircraft, that remain within the Earth's atmosphere for the duration of their flight. They fly very close to the ground, typically along a pre-programmed flight path, making them a bit harder to detect, whereas ballistic missiles travel much faster than cruise missiles in a parabolic trajectory with most of their flight outside of the atmosphere. The U.S. currently has other tactical nuclear weapons in its inventory. There are air-launched cruise missiles carried by B-52s, Trident submarine-launched ballistic missiles with tactical nuclear warheads, and gravity bombs carried by a mix of stealthy aircraft, B-2s, F-35s, and non-stealthy aircraft, F-16s or F-15s. It's worth noting that tactical nuclear weapons have never been used in a conflict, although just yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that they will be practicing the deployment of tactical nuclear weapons during an upcoming military exercise. There's a bit of history and context to understand in the larger discussion about the SLCMN program. The U.S. formerly had sea-launched cruise missiles equipped with nuclear warheads in the form of Tomahawk land attack missiles, or TLAMs. That was up until 1991 when President George H.W. Bush ordered them to be removed from submarines. Fast forward to 2010 under the Obama administration, that administration declared that they were a redundant capability and announced their retirement with the Navy completing the retirement of those TLAMs in 2013. Again, fast forwarding to 2018, under the Trump administration's nuclear posture review, that product called for the development of a new SLCMN to fill a gap in the U.S. arsenal for low-yield nuclear response. Then moving forward again to the 2022 nuclear posture review, under the Biden administration, they announced the cancellation of that program, although Congress overrode them both in the 2024 NDAA as well as the appropriations bill declaring it a program of record. So with that, I'll move into introductions of both of our discussants today. As I mentioned, we have Robert Sufer, from a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he leads the Nuclear Strategy Project. He's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies. He's formerly a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear and Missile Defense Policy. He was a staff lead for the Senate Armed Services Committee Subcommittee on Strategic Forces. He's the author of Missile Defense and Western European Security. He received his doctorate in international relations from the University of Southern California and is a graduate of the National War College. Eric Gomez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, where he focuses on the U.S. military budget, force posture, as well as arms control and nuclear stability issues in East Asia. He was a member of the Project on Nuclear Issues, the Nuclear Scholars Initiative Program, where he conducted research on the impacts of U.S. intermediate-range missiles on U.S.-China strategic stability. He's the co-editor of America's Nuclear Crossroads, a forward-looking anthology. He received his MA in International Affairs from the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. So with that, I'll turn it over to Robert.
Do you want to say hello there?
Yeah, I think. Okay.
Thank you so much. Welcome to everybody. And thank you for the invitation to join you. You know, I feel kind of like that politician who's ahead in the polls and not sure whether he should debate the opponent because there's only downsides. Well, as you know, Congress has actually authorized and appropriated funding for the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile. So so in a sense, the debate's over. But as most of us who know who've worked here on Capitol Hill, no issue in Washington is ever truly closed, right? And there's still a chance that this thing could be turned around. In fact, you know, we've been debating this nuclear sea-launched cruise missile for over 6 years. Don't let it be said that we've taken this this decision, you know, in a frivolous nature, or that it's just, you know, the bureaucratic desire for more nuclear weapons. 6 years. I want to talk to you a little bit about how we came to the decision to support the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile in the Trump nuclear posture review, 2017 and 18. And the arguments then are the same as they are today, and I would just argue that perhaps the expansion of China's capability now makes them even more imperative. So, you know, when we conducted the nuclear posture review, whenever you do these reviews, the first thing you want to do is take into account the strategic environment, what's going on at the time, right? And one of the big differences between the Trump NPR and the Obama NPR was the changing relationship with Russia and China to some extent. So under Biden, you had the hoped for reset in relations with Russia. By the time you get to the end of the Obama administration, you start hearing the phrase strategic competition, right, with China and Russia. And this was the environment in which we evaluated our nuclear posture in the Trump administration in the 2017-2018 period, right? And so what kept us awake at night was not the nuclear balance at the strategic level, you know, the ICBMs, the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the long-range bombers, all those strategic forces which are covered by the New START Treaty. The balance was more or less equal. Russia was developing some of these novel systems, but we didn't think they really changed the military balance. So that wasn't the problem. The problem really was nuclear weapons that are used in the region as opposed to transcontinental. Sometimes we refer to them as non-strategic nuclear weapons, regional nuclear weapons, theater nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons. It's all those nuclear weapons that aren't covered by the New START Treaty. And what we noticed was that despite the fact that we had essentially eliminated virtually all of our tactical nuclear weapons at the end of the Cold War, except for the B-61 bombs that we now have in Europe, Russia, which had actually begun to eliminate some of its capabilities, was now rebuilding its tactical nuclear weapon stockpiles. And we said at the unclassified level that Russia had up to about 2,000 of these weapons. And it wasn't just the numbers that bothered us, it was the different types. They have their own sort of mini tactical nuclear triad of tactical nuclear weapons, right? They have sea-based systems, ground-based systems, air launch systems, cruise missiles. In the Navy alone, they have depth charges, torpedoes. Why do you need all those capabilities? So we're trying to understand why they have these capabilities. And many of these capabilities, by the way, are dual capable. They're actually, you know, conventional depth charges, but you can put a nuclear core in them and convert them into nuclear use. So this is really what troubled us the most. And then we started to see that they were exercising to these capabilities. And you just heard that Russia has threatened to exercise its tactical nuclear weapons now as a response to certain geopolitical threats. But this has been going on for some time now, right? So we knew that they were exercising to this, And then we also could see in their written doctrine that the employment of nuclear weapons in a limited way in the region would be part of their strategy. That was sort of the NATO strategy during the Cold War. If you're losing a battle conventionally, you might opt to use nuclear weapons in order to coerce the other side to back down or blackmail them or achieve victory in the battlefield ultimately. And so a combination of these numbers, the doctrine, and that they were exercising to this doctrine led us to believe that they may think, they being the Russians, they may think that in a war with NATO, that they could use nuclear weapons in a limited way. And it's not just the low yield aspect of it, but it's the limited aspect of it. They could use nuclear weapons in a limited way and get us to back down. And what we had to do, we felt what we had to do, was disabuse them of this notion and bolster deterrence at the regional level. So again, it wasn't a problem of a strategic nuclear exchange with Russia. The problem was at the regional level. And we deploy about one-tenth the number of nuclear weapons that Russia deploys in this category. Again, as I said, for NATO, it's the B-61 bomb flown by U.S. fighters and some allied fighters as well. And we felt that wasn't enough, right, to create that deterrent effect in the mind of the Russians. And so we said we had to do something to bolster deterrence, right? Deterrence is about creating a perception in the mind of the adversary that that you're willing to use a capability and create a cost that would be out of proportion to any gains. In other words, you can say to the Russian that if you come in and use nuclear weapons, we're going to respond, or you can show it, you can demonstrate it. And we felt that because we had not deployed a new nuclear capability since the end of the Cold War, we actually had to field something, right? And so the next question was, what should we field in Europe? We could add more B-61 bombs, more fighters, which we already have. But the problem with that is, a few problems. One is, unless you have warning time and you generate these forces and get them survivable during a crisis, they actually provide a target, an excuse for Russia to launch perhaps a disarming first strike against your nuclear capabilities. So adding more of that didn't help enhance the survivability of NATO's nuclear forces. Then the other problem was if you wanted to deploy a ground-based system, maybe a mobile missile, which could be hidden in a forest, and as you know, we had INF missiles in the 80s. The problem with that is you would have to ask the Allies to base these nuclear weapons on their territory, and while that may have been achievable, why go through all that political pain and frustration when you had another capability which you could deploy offshore in submarines, right? And so the advantage of the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile was that it could have presence, you know, out at sea. The Russians wouldn't know where the ship was. They wouldn't know how many we had. It would be there all the time, and it would be a very prompt response in the case where NATO's dual-capable aircraft were not available. The other problem with the dual-capable aircraft, it became apparent to us, is despite the fact that the F-35 is more stealthy than the current generation of fighters, still there were a lot of heavy air defenses deployed protecting critical Russian targets, and it would be difficult for those aircraft to break through. And again, if you have a nuclear cruise missile, you can avoid the air defense problem. And so that was another advantage. So again, the advantage of that cruise missile was it had presence. It was always there. It was survivable because you couldn't eliminate it. You couldn't find it, so you couldn't eliminate it. So it was present. It was survivable, and it could be used very promptly. You didn't have to necessarily involve NATO on this. You didn't have to fly, a B-52 bomber from Europe. From the United States to Europe and drop a cruise missile. It was always there. And you don't have to generate forces. You don't have to keep them on alert. Again, the submarine is always out there. It's survivable. It's present. And it sends a very important message to your allies that you are bolstering deterrence, that you're doing what's necessary to send a signal to Russia that there's no way that they can conceive of using nuclear weapons in a limited way and that we would back down. All right? So fast forward to the current day. If you read the Biden nuclear posture review, there's no argument over the need to deter both large-scale nuclear attacks and limited nuclear attacks. The Biden NPR is quite clear that the ability to deter limited nuclear threats is critical to the decision of the president as to whether or not he or she would send U.S. forces into harm's way, right? So if you think that if you're sending U.S. troops against an adversary that has nuclear weapons, if you don't have a reasonable confidence that you can deter them from using nuclear weapons, it's going to be kind of risky. You may think twice about it. Now, the debate here is whether or not, with our current nuclear programs, we can achieve that deterrent effect, or do you need more? And what the Biden administration says is, we agree about the problem, we agree about the threat, but we think that the current nuclear forces, which are currently being modernized, is sufficient to address the threat, right? And so what we can rely on is we have, again, the B-61 bomb delivered by tactical aircraft deployed in Europe. We also have bombers that can be flown from the United States carrying air-launched cruise missiles, or the new version, which is called a long-range standoff weapon, which could be delivered. We also have a low-yield submarine-launched ballistic missile warhead that potentially could be employed. So there are some capabilities that we can use, but the question is it enough? Is it enough? And what I come back to is the fact that Russia and China have been looking at what the United States has been doing over the last 30 years in terms of nuclear modernization. And literally, up until the Obama administration, we have spent only enough money to maintain and sustain the old stuff. Okay, and we've eschewed any type of tactical nuclear weapon. The situation now is getting worse. China, I didn't mention China, but China also has regional nuclear capabilities. According to the U.S. Strategic Command commander's written testimony before the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, China has about 1,000 short, medium, intermediate-range missiles that can be armed with nuclear weapons. That's 1,000. Do you know how many the U.S. deploys? Zero. Right? So if you think that disparity doesn't matter, if you think that disparity doesn't weaken deterrence, if you think that we can address that disparity through U.S. nuclear weapons deployed to the United States, then of course you don't need the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile. But we think we do, because, again, it's not just about a specific capability, but it's about deterrence. And I'll end with this quote from Senator Angus King, who's an independent, but he's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee Subcommittee for Strategic Forces. He had a hearing last year on this. And he says, you know, I think of the formula for deterrence as will plus capacity. Right? Capacity is capability, having the weapons, and will is the willingness to use it. And in fact, it's not just plus, it's not additive, it's the product, it's multiplication. Because if your will is zero, it doesn't matter how much capability you have, the other side doesn't think you're going to use it. But he says, I think of the formula for deterrence as will plus capacity. And will is a hard thing to measure and quantify. Capacity, though, is something that can be measured. Capacity is something that can be measured. Angus King, of course, supports the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile. And I think, in a sense, deploying SLCM, even in modest numbers, is a signal of resolve, is a signal of will. It's a tangible deterrence message to our adversaries and our allies that there is no scenario for nuclear use to which the United States cannot respond. And by sending that deterrence message, you avoid nuclear use at the outset. A lot more can be said, but we'll save it for the Q&A. Thank you.
Eric, I know Robert said the debate's over, but since you work at the Cato Institute, we'll still give you a shot.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming today. So, yeah, Rob's a tough act to follow, but I'm going to try. And I'm going to begin by conceding some points to him, because he is right that SLCM N would increase the flexibility of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. It could provide this interesting new option for doing things with escalation control. That's not wrong. But especially as members of congressional staff, that's not the metric you need to judge it by. As members of congressional staffers who are concerned about things like appropriations and authorizations for the national NDAA process, you need to think about opportunity costs.
right?
What do you forego, or what are the potential things that you give up by increasing nuclear forces? And I argue that when it comes to both deterring conflict in general and controlling escalation, the U.S. would be better served by not spending money on the Slick Amend program, but instead improving conventional capabilities instead. And this is important because when we talk about this fear of adversary limited nuclear use, this isn't happening in a vacuum, right? I don't think it's very credible to say that China or Russia is just going to pop off some regional nuclear weapon for no reason, right? This is most likely going to occur in a situation where a conventional conflict between the United States and these countries is already underway, which means you have to, I think the better way to think about how you deter is not this sort of fine-grained, like, deterrence in with nuclear forces. It's how do we prevent the conflict from happening in the first place? And I think in that situation, the balance of conventional forces is a much more important and meaningful measure of what is going to happen than the balance of nuclear forces. Take the Russian experience in Ukraine right now, right? Yeah, Russia does have a big advantage over the United States in terms of tactical nuclear weapons. Doesn't seem to be doing them all that well, though, in Ukraine. At best, they've only started to make some marginal gains, and a lot of that is because of American conventional capacity to support Ukraine, not nuclear capacity. Also, foregoing Slick Amend would not leave the United States without any options. Yes, Rob talked a bit about W-76 Mark II, B-61 Mark 12, and now the new Mark 13, the long-range strike, the LRSO on bombers. I think, you know, if you really want to have a lot more nuclear weapon, low-yield nuclear weapons quickly, the conversion process of W-76 warheads to the Mark II was pretty quick and relatively low cost, so we could do that if we needed to. and I'm less worried about the target generation problem, the nuclear generation problem as well. You know, that one of the arguments in favor of Slick Amend is that it's supposed to be prompt, it's supposed to be on station right away. Maybe if the war happens and the subs are far away, they might take more time to transit from their areas where they load up the weapon to where they're going to be launching it from. It takes a lot less time, for example, for a U.S. bomber to fly from CONUS to a launch point in the Asia Pacific than it does for a U.S. submarine to make that same trip. Also, because you have a conflict, if this is happening within a conflict that's already started, we're going to want to be using those bombers for conventional missions anyway, so they will already be alerted, they will already be generating for other missions. The sort of dual-capable problem cuts both ways with the bomber force already. And so I think that we could leverage that to our advantage in a conflict. When I look at the world's, I'm much more concerned about China than Russia. I think that the Russian experience in Ukraine makes it less likely or less of a threat to NATO than more of a threat, especially if the NATO countries get their acts together and do balancing. I am much more worried about China, right? Because not only is China, the China-U.S. balance look dicier for the United States, but also regional allies are just, even if they massively increase defense spending, still will be outweighed by China, right? And so when it comes to deterring conflict and controlling escalation within conflict, better, more capable conventional forces for the United States and our friends are more important to that question than one additional low-yield nuclear weapon when we already have several options on the way. And to illustrate some of these, you know, what do I mean by opportunity cost? So Slick Amend, right now, the sort of short-term costs are relatively low relative to the rest of the nuclear modernization program. That's the good news. The problem is when they ramp up. So the 2023 CBO estimate puts the Slick Amend warhead, or Slick Amend plus its warhead at about $10 billion over a 10-year period if the program began this year. But that doesn't include any of production costs after 2032 when you'd likely get to full rate production, or the cost of updating vessels, naval vessels, to actually take the system, which could add who knows how many in the range of billions of dollars, when you'd also have to take those ships out of service in order to make those upgrades. In 2022, the U.S. Navy said the Slick Amend cancellation would save $2 billion over the next 5 years. This money is not necessarily evenly distributed, though. So what you're most likely to see is a situation where, in the first few years of the program, the spending is relatively small, something on the orders of the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, as you do initial research and development. But then program costs are going to ramp up as you move from research and development into production. We're seeing it now with Columbia, with the Sentinel, right, with the other US nuclear modernization programs. It's causing what's known as the bow wave, right? This idea that nuclear modernization costs get very big after staying low for a while. And it's already leading to questions about what do you afford to build in a constrained budget environment. In a 2021 memo from the Secretary of the Navy, he said, quote, "The Navy can't afford to simultaneously develop the next generation of air, surface, and subsurface platforms and must prioritize these programs," churned it too soon, "must prioritize these programs, balancing the costs of developing the next generation of capabilities against maintaining current ones." That was in an environment where Slick Amend already wasn't in the picture, right? So it was even more sort of, I don't know, freewheeling sounds like too big of a word, but it was already in a more permissive budgetary environment. In the FY25 budget, the Navy cuts spending on new conventional systems but fully funds existing nuclear modernization efforts. In a quote in a Breaking Defense piece on this issue, citing an undersecretary, they said, "The department fully funded the sea-based portions of the nuclear deterrence triad, but leaving insufficient money to cover other shipbuilding and modernization priorities." These trade-offs are already happening, right? We're already having to make some hard choices about getting future capabilities at the conventional level or future nuclear ones, even when the Slick Amend cost is so low. Assuming that we don't have, and this is a big assumption maybe, but assuming that we don't have the sort of political willpower to, you know, take defense spending upwards of $1.5 trillion a year, these trade-offs matter. And I would not like to see defense spending get that high. If there is political will for it, some of these arguments get weaker. But I think we have to assume a constrained budgetary environment. So yeah, Slick Amend is not as expensive as some of the other big priorities, but we're already seeing these trade-offs show up in real time. And even if it's smaller, why do it in the first place? To also illustrate, Indo-PACOM had an unfunded priorities list of $11 billion this year, $1 billion for the Tomahawk, which is the conventional equivalent of this. So there's already things that when you ask Indo-PACOM, hey, you know, what would you like more money for? They don't say more nuclear systems, right? The warfighters don't want more of this. They need more conventional systems. Program cost growth. So like I said before, Slick Amend trade-offs are not a huge problem in the next year or two. But if you sink the costs now, cutting them will be harder later when the program costs increase and become more painful. And a lot of our other major nuclear modernization efforts are already facing delays. One of the big arguments that proponents of Slick Amend make is that you can get this relatively cheap, right? The idea that because it might have commonality on the warhead and commonality in other missile designs with other things that we are producing, that means that some of the, you know, R&D costs might be lower. Maybe that might be true, but given the history of major program or major weapons programs like this, I think that's far too optimistic. And I think that we should assume that costs will go over. And again, all that does is make this trade-off cost, make this opportunity cost question all the more pressing. So, to reiterate my main point, I don't think the U.S. should continue to fund the Slick Amend. Even though the weapon provides benefits related to increased flexibility for nuclear escalation controls, the positives are outweighed by the costs. Right? Money would be much better spent on improving U.S. conventional forces and the conventional forces of allies, especially in East Asia, where the balance with China is bad on the conventional level. and that stronger conventional forces are a better way to both prevent conflict in the first place and to control escalation once you are in conflict. Right? We already have other regional nuclear forces at our disposal that we can lean on. If need be, we can purchase more of them, but that will have a lower cost than investing in a new program. Finally, you know, as staffers, right, when it comes to talking with the DoD, it's really important that you present this as a trade-off, because that's what it is, right? If you just ask a STRATCOM commander, hey, do you want more thing? He's going to say yes. Who wouldn't, right? Of course they're going to say yes. But don't give them that option, because that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about constrained resources. You're talking about money that is not, I sincerely hope, is not infinite. You need to, when it comes to, you know, the questions that your bosses ask these people, you need to present it as a trade-off, right? What is your top priority as a combatant commander? Like, if you could only have one or two things, what would those one or two things be? Is it the SLCCM, or is it more of something else? But don't give them the out. Don't give them the out of saying, you know, hey, if you could have everything you ever wanted, what would you like? The way I kind of was thinking about this is that, you know, you have like a car. SLCCM N is a nice hood ornament on the car, but the wheels are balding, right? We need more conventional forces to bolster deterrence, and that is a much better way to spend the resources than this program. So, thank you very much. We are looking forward to your questions.
So now we'll move into the discussion, the question and answer phase. Please raise your hand if you have a question. I'll call on you, and just give me a moment to repeat the question so our online audience can hear it as well, and then we'll turn it over to the discussants. Before we go into the Q&A, Robert, I think I'll just give you the opportunity to offer up your thoughts on the points that Eric raises in regards to opportunity cost. It's important to highlight that in the FY24 Defense Appropriations Package, SLCCM N, the money allotted to that was only around $130 million, but Eric cites the between $10 and $30 billion over 10 years with INDOPACOM this year alone having an unfunded priority list of $11 billion.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a fair argument. It's a fair point. I would just point out that the amount of money that we spend in the Department of Defense for nuclear weapons, just to maintain the basic capabilities that we have, it's about 3%, maybe 3.5% of the DoD budget. All of this modernization, the additional funding for the new submarine, the new bomber, the new ICBM, the new cruise missiles, that's going to add about an additional 3.5% to the DoD budget. So you'll be spending 7.5%, maybe 8% of the DoD budget on nuclear weapons for maybe 10 years or so, and then it'll go back down to 3 or 4%. If you can solve this conventional problem with an additional 3% of DoD budget, then I'd consider the argument. But I don't think you're going to get that much savings out of it. But more importantly, with respect to the Sea Launch Cruise Missile, again, if CBO is saying that it's going to cost about $10 billion to develop, look, I think that's on the high side, quite frankly, because you really have two missiles to choose from. You have the existing Tomahawk missile, which was the missile that we used during the Cold War for this mission. We're now in the fourth or fifth generation of the Tomahawk, and you can just use that weapon and nuclearize it, right? Or you can take the long-range standoff weapon, which is what's being built now to replace air-launched cruise missile. We spent about $6 billion to develop that, and you can figure out some way to marinize that, to put it in a submarine. So there's ways that we can do this, which are, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but it amounts essentially couch change for the Pentagon.
Sure, can I respond to that? So I hear the argument about the, you know, the small percentages. I think that's, Rob is right in terms of the overall DoD budget. I think that's the wrong slice of the pie to look at, though, because a big chunk of the overall DoD budget is for things like salaries and benefits for troops, right? There are costs that are related to personnel or buildings that don't really change that much year on year. The better thing to look at are things like weapons acquisition accounts and other types of like new procurement. And like I said, we're seeing it now, right? The Secretary of the Navy saying, we are punting on certain modernization efforts and programs because, especially this year with the budget caps, we see, you know, we have to make this trade-off. And they're not choosing to cut the nukes, right? They're choosing to cut the future conventional force. And I think, you know, we can debate about the benefits of that, but, you know, you use the conventional stuff. You actually use it. And I think that when looking at this trade-off question again, whole DoD budget is the wrong way to look at it. And we're seeing what happens when the services have to make, you know, have to sacrifice conventional modernization.
So with that, we'll open it up to the audience here. Just a reminder, just state your name and affiliation, and we'll go from there. So for those who are watching online, the question is reference to a specific use case for SLCMN where a commander would employ it.
Right. So the scenarios are infinite, okay? My first point is that this is not about having a weapon that can hold certain targets at risk. So I think that any target that you think that you need to reach with other capabilities, we probably have a way to do that, maybe less efficiently. Okay, it's not about holding specific targets at risk. It's about increasing the level of risk to China and to Russia. They have to understand that there is no scenario where they could use nuclear weapons and we're not going to respond. And my point is that since we have not increased the size of our tactical nuclear weapons essentially since 1990. You may be leading them to believe that we're not serious about using those capabilities, okay? But let me add another layer of complexity to this. So we may have a capability that can do two out of three of these, but maybe that third aspect is what you need for deterrence. I don't know. But now that we are facing two major adversaries, two nuclear powers, two different parts of the world, you're further straining your nuclear capabilities, right? And so If you are fighting a major conventional war with the Russians in NATO Europe, and this escalates to the use of nuclear weapons in the region, we have the B-61 bombs there, we have the fighters there. They may or may not be able to accomplish their mission. We're also going to be maintaining our strategic forces on alert to make sure Russians don't use strategic nuclear weapons against us. Now, if China takes this as an opportunity to attack in the Indo-Pacific, we're now going to have to fight another conventional war over there and worry also about China's escalation to nuclear use. And the question is, would you have enough nuclear weapons to be able to address both of these scenarios at the same time, given the fact that some of these capabilities, like the fighters and the bombers, would be used in the conventional mission? The tankers that would be used to support U.S. aircraft heading over to Europe may not be available to support the fighter bombers that would be necessary in the Indo-Pacific to drop nuclear bombs. So, as Representative Moulton can get together with U.S. Strategic Command and the Indo-Pacific Commander and ask that question, and I bet you that they will give you a specific scenario where that's the case. But it's the combination of all those capabilities. But most importantly, I think it's the survivability and the fact that it's always there. The Russians and the Chinese don't know how many are out there. They don't know where they're located, but they know they're there, and they know that we have a way of responding to a limited nuclear strike.
Eric, do you care to elaborate on anything Robert said?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Robert raised a point about all the conventional enablers that support the nuclear strike missions, and it's like, well, you have enough of those. It's like, well, then let's get more money for the conventional stuff too. I think that this is where the role, you know, when we talk about the two nuclear peer adversaries, I think that's where the role of like the local allies and partners matters a lot, in the sense that I think it's not there yet, but I think that Europe and NATO members, if they got their act together on defense spending and force posture, could present a pretty credible deterrent, both nuclear and conventional, to further Russian aggression in Europe. Asia is the harder case. And so, you know, one way to potentially reduce this problem, or to make this difficult problem of the two peers more manageable, is to figure out ways to get the Europeans to, you know, do more. I won't get into what those potential ways may be, because that's a whole other set of conversations. But I think that really illustrates, you know, China is the big problem here. And as far as, you know, the unique characteristics of the weapon, I just think that because any of this consideration would be happening in a conventional warfare scenario anyway, things like the promptness, I don't think prompt nuclear response options matter. I think, you know, survivable nuclear response options matter. Retaliation need not be prompt, only assured. Maybe that's just the part of the nuclear priesthood that raised me. I don't think that, you know, the difference of, you know, a B-21 or a B-2 lifting off from the central United States, flying to Asia in about 12-ish hour, not even less, because if you have an LRSO, you don't need to get over China, right? Flying, say, 8 or 9 hours to get to a launch point, firing it, you know, you're like versus a submarine that's even if the submarine is in a perfect location to begin with, that's a difference of hours, right? Like that's still pretty prompt to me, unless you're shooting at mobile things, which if you're going to shoot at mobile things with nuclear weapons, you know, shoot more nukes. I don't see how we couldn't do some relatively minor changes in how we conduct these operations with what we have already and what's already in the pipeline that, like, can fix the problems that Rob identifies. And also, I think it raises this interesting question of, well, what happens with a submarine that has slick men on it gets destroyed? What do we do? Is that an attack on the nuclear force? Is that something that automatically triggers massive retaliation response on our part? I don't know. I'd rather not have to ask that question. But I think that's another aspect here that, you know, hasn't been brought up yet. Anyway, I'm done now.
So actually, we keep unraveling new arguments. You raise a submarine point. And by the way, Mr. Moulton has been very good in pointing out the expansion of China's nuclear capabilities, the fact that our programs are delayed and they seem to be accelerating. So I know he's sensitive to these issues. And by the way, you know, we haven't developed the concept of operations for this system. We don't know even how many we're going to deploy. For instance, at the end of the Cold War, we had about 300 nuclear Tomahawk land attack missiles deployed. I doubt we probably deploy more than that. We're not talking about adding thousands of weapons to our arsenal, just a few hundred, again, to create that deterrent effect, right? So that's the first point. But in terms of the submarine point, I didn't mention this because it wasn't a selling point, if you will, for Slick Amen during the Trump review, and that is, with the expansion of China's capabilities and the fact that we have to fight two at the same time, the survivability of U.S. nuclear forces becomes paramount. And I think we all have great confidence that our nuclear ballistic missile submarines are survivable, but given the advancements in technology like quantum computing and new sensors, there may come a day when they can find the submarines, right? And so we only have 12 submarines. Some small number of those are deployed at any one time. During a crisis, we'll get more out. But, you know, at the most, they have to find, you know, maybe 10 submarines. If you now put nuclear cruise missiles on our attack submarines, which could be 50, 60, 70, you have made this an insoluble problem for the Russians and the Chinese. So it enhances the overall survivability of the U.S. nuclear triad.
But those submarines are going to be operating most likely closer to the anti-submarine capabilities of the adversary, no?
Yeah, but you lose one or two, it doesn't matter. And by the way, there's no automaticity. There's no automaticity. We don't say that if there's an attack against a U.S. nuclear force that we respond automatically. It's going to be situation dependent. We lose a submarine, we're not going to launch nuclear World War III just because we've lost an attack submarine.
Confidence to say that one tactical nuclear weapon means we do not continue escalating up the ladder.
Yeah.
So just briefly for those online, the question was in reference to escalation in a specific use case.
Right. So that's one of the issues that we debated during the Cold War. We never reached a conclusion whether or not you could keep nuclear war limited, right? Some scholars would say that the fact that there's a risk that this thing could escalate uncontrollably actually adds to the deterrent effect. But what we need to do is we need to at least create the impression in the mind of the Russian or the Chinese that we're willing to use nuclear weapons in this scenario. And having large nuclear weapons deployed in the United States is deemed to be less credible than having smaller nuclear weapons deployed in the region.
Who's doing that deeming?
Who's doing that? Well, it's first of all, this is the policy that we've had for over 60, 70 years. Republican and Democratic administrations have said that. If you like, we can chat about this later, and I'll show you the documentation. But look, you talked about a war game. Nobody knows what happens, right? Once a nuclear weapon is used, you know there is an abhorrence of nuclear use. After the first one is used, and maybe one is fired in response, isn't it just as likely that the two leaders will say, my God, what have we wrought? We have to stop this. Our objective must be to prevent further escalation. Why isn't that just as logical as your scenario where it just escalates willy-nilly, uncontrollably to nuclear Armageddon?
You know what you don't have to worry about with this? Conventional weapons. Right. So when it comes to right deterrence and this, the will and capability, you know, formula that Rob talked about earlier, you know, an important part of all this is like the credibility of their use, right? And I think that nuclear threats in general are difficult to, especially threats of like limited first use, are very difficult to make credible if you aren't already in a sort of survival. Now the North Koreans, when they're like, we're gonna use right away and big because we have no choice, like, you know, you're going to kill us no matter what, so we might as well get our shots off. I believe them. But for countries like China and Russia, who are the primary target of the Slicker Men, that decision of, you know, do we escalate first is still hard, even without, Slicker Men might make it a little harder. But conventional weapons are, like, inherently credible, right? You know, because, like, this is, like, the big trade-off, right? It's, like, do you need a force posture of, like, more damage with less credibility, or do you want less credibility but lower, like, damage thresholds when it comes to conventional weapons? I don't know. I think that I would rather see greater investment in the conventional forces. Because, you know, we already have the existing programs of record on the nuclear side. I think that's sustainable. I don't know. But the question of, like, who deems it, you know, who deems the threshold where? Like, we have one set of discussions about how much is enough, and the Chinese and the Russians have their own set of discussions about how much is enough. And, yeah, that, like, one of the core tensions in all of nuclear studies of, you know, are we accurately gauging them and are they accurately gauging us?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Jackson DuPont and I'm here with the Council on Strategic Risks. And our question is, you know, why fund Slicker Men if the previous Indo-Pacific commander it was not in his unfunded budget request and has not publicly
asked for it. And the current commander who just entered into the role recently, who was the previous U.S. Pacific Fleet commander and would be the commander custodian of the naval, was the commander custodian of the naval force for Indo-PACOM, did not ask for it in that role. So just kind of helping us get in the mindset, if the people who are the custodians, the stewards, and those responsible for targeting the deployment of the weapons in the warfighting capacity have not asked for it, what is the justification?
So the question is reference to demand from combatant commanders, specifically Indo-PACOM, of the Slick Amend system.
Good question. The Indo-Pacific commander, his or her job is to fight the conventional fight primarily. Fight tonight, right? And so he has, as you pointed out ably, he has shortcomings in conventional nuclear conventional forces that he needs to fulfill. But having said that, you do know that General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, supported this. The vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Grady, supported this. The previous chief of naval operations, General Admiral Richardson, who participated in the nuclear posture review that I conducted, supported it. Admiral Franchetti, the new chief of naval operations, has supported it as well. Not to mention Todd Walter, the former UCOM commander, who actually is a regional combatant commander, he also supported the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile in the context of a European fight. So it's a mixed bag, and I think that you can understand why the Indo-Pacific commander would focus primarily on the conventional forces.
I don't have any unique insight into that.
All right, we'll turn it back to the audience.
Yes.
So you've talked a little bit about the threshold to use it, but I think something we've kind of danced around for the most part is nuclear weapons' ability to end a war most of it more effectively than basically anything else we've seen, and more quickly. Mr. Super, you touched on that a little bit, but would you mind elaborating, at what point does the calculus for the imminent change because of the use of nuclear weapons? I mean, you see that with Russia, right? Like, they're being, repelled back with conventional stuff, but we're still going.
So the question was in reference to the ability for nuclear weapons to be determinative of a conflict and force it into conclusion.
Yeah, that's very speculative. It's hard. It's an important question, and it's a question that every regional combatant commander, as well as the U.S. president, needs to wrestle with. And it is U.S. policy. Our nuclear policy is that if an adversary were to use nuclear weapons against us in a limited way, look, if they attack our cities and destroy the United States, we're going to respond massively against it. But that's not how this is going to develop, probably. It's going to emerge out of a conventional war, right? And if they were to use nuclear weapons because they felt that they were losing, and they felt they were worried about the end of their regime, and they were to use nuclear weapons, our strategy then would be to respond in a proportionate way, or nearly proportionate way, with the anticipation of stopping further escalation. What we want to do is send a message of resolve to the adversary and say, you thought that you could snatch victory out of the jaws of defeat by using nuclear weapons against us? Well, you were wrong. We've responded, but we've demonstrated restraint, right? We demonstrated restraint, and we're suggesting to them that if you continue to use nuclear weapons, this is going to end bad for you. This is going to end bad. And that's sort of the best way that I can answer your question. But if you talk to a military commander, they would say, if you're going to use that nuclear weapon in response to the adversary, let's get some military effectiveness out of this. So, for instance, if China were to be attacking Taiwan, and somehow this would escalate to Chinese nuclear use because they felt that the invasion wasn't succeeding, well, we would use nuclear weapons to sink their invasion fleet. That's it. They're done. They can't invade Taiwan. That ends the war. Maybe. It's hard to say, right?
Yeah. It is very. That is very difficult to know. And I think, what's coming out, I think, in a lot of these questions is, the role of uncertainty in all this is pretty significant. I had, a half-formed thought, and I'm like, I don't know if it's a good one. So I'm hesitant to say it.
Well, we'll keep that in.
Yeah, let's just keep it inside.
Keep that in the internal dialogue of Eric Gomez. I think we've got time for one more question. So,
hey, so Robert from the Office of Rep Air and Navy.
I think one of the points that I heard earlier that I want to explore a little, particularly in light of the trade-offs with conventional versus nuclear forces, is you said something to the effect of there are very few targets that we could not hit with conventional weapons, albeit at potentially less efficient. But in light of the struggles that we currently have with our nuclear modernization program and everything from Sentinel being nearly twice over to plutonium pit production being 3 to 10 times over, depending on how you calculate it, the advantages that we achieve seem to be a demonstration of strength, so to speak, but the risk is this uncertainty. And I'm really struggling in my mind to envision a scenario where a losing adversary feels so desperate as to break the nuclear taboo that they resort to using nukes, that we then use nukes in response, and they don't proceed up the escalation ladder. And so I guess I hear a lot of risk and not a lot of gain in these sorts of weapons. And I'm just wondering, is there anything you can do to try and reassure us that there is going to be a break-even point where a threatened Russian leader won't see a strike and say, all bets off? Like, I just can't imagine in an active combat environment the ability to rationally determine. Like, we got close during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We backed down, but we did it over days over telegrams.
So the question was in reference to the escalatory aspects of Slick and Men, and if there is a case where it might bring escalation to a close rather than further escalate the situation.
Again, another tough question, and this is, it's really difficult to answer, but let me try this way. In the first instance, this is all about deterring war at the outset, conventional war as well as nuclear war, right? And you see what Russia is doing now with exercising their tactical nuclear weapons. Yeah, it's probably for trying to gain political leverage, right, to get the United States and the European allies to stop providing conventional support to Ukrainians. But it also demonstrates that they might contemplate using these nuclear weapons. So I think we have to take into account that they may think about using them, and so we need to have a response. And by having a response that registers in Putin's mind will give him pause about using them in the first place. That's the first thing. The second thing is, again, we cannot know what will happen after the first nuclear weapon goes off. We just can't know that. But I can tell you, based on the people that I've worked for, Secretary Mattis, most of the senior leadership, if you look at the type of exercises that we conduct at the classified level, rarely do we conduct an exercise where we go first with nuclear weapons. We are so, when we say in our nuclear posture review, Republicans and Democrats have said, we will only use nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances. We mean it. It's going to be extreme. We did not use them when we were about to be pushed off the Korean Peninsula during the First Korean War. We did not use it when the Chinese came across the Yalu River. We did not use it in Vietnam. We haven't used nuclear weapons in what were arguably some extreme circumstances. I think you might take some comfort from the fact that it's going to be a very difficult decision for any president to take. And if nuclear weapons are used, it's going to be the first thing on the mind of a president, I believe, this is Rob Sufer speaking, is he's going to ask for advice, how do I make this stop? How do I stop further escalation? And that's going to lead to certain choices that will be more likely to de-escalate the crisis than to escalate. But who the hell knows? You're dealing with Putin, right? Deterrence is a psychological equation. All I'm suggesting is that we are afraid at this point that given the disparity in tactical nuclear weapons, Russia and China may believe that they have an advantage. We can disagree whether that's the case or not, but that's the argument. And what we're suggesting is not building 5,000 more nuclear weapons. Heck, give me 300 nuclear weapons sprinkled around some submarines, and let's call it a day. And I think that provides the deterrent effect. Putin and Xi will say, my God, the Americans are really serious about this. They're actually, they debated this thing for 6 years, and they finally reached a conclusion that we're gonna deploy some capability. We see what Russia and China are doing, and this is our best way of responding to that in a measured, moderate approach.
Dang it, Rob. You answer questions so well. I have trouble thinking of things to add. I think at a bigger, to pull it out a bit, I think this is like the tension of extended deterrence par excellence, right? Where in many cases we are, threatening to go to war with other great powers over things that are much closer to them, that they probably innately care more about than we do. And that's been like the tension at the heart of extended deterrence since the beginning, right? If we didn't have a nuclear umbrella to NATO or to Japan or to South Korea, who gives a shit if we need a slick amend? Oh, shoot, we're being live streamed. Who cares, right? Like, we don't really, you know, then all you really need is the something survivable enough to do a secure second strike, and you're done. But because we've extended the umbrella, this is like, it's the business we have chosen for ourselves. Does this need to be the case forever? I don't know. I'll just leave that out there. But when it comes to, yeah, we've put ourselves into this situation, and it's really hard. And now we're kind of in the position of, you know, in the Cold War, we were very worried about Soviet conventional advantages erode, and like we were the ones relying, I think, more on limited nuclear options and nuclear war fighting, especially in the early Cold War, to address those. I think now it's kind of been put on the other foot. I think the Russians and the Chinese, even though we like, you know, even though we're worried about, you know, where the conventional balances are heading, I think the Russians and the Chinese perceive our conventional forces as much stronger than we perceive them. And so because they're nervous about that, they're doing what we did. They're trying to invest in more conventional or more nuclear forces to try and make up the difference. So I don't know. Yeah, these questions about like war termination and how does this actually happen are very good and essential, and I have no freaking clue. Because, yeah, the hope is that you deter it in the first place. And I think the big difference between Rob and I is where do we see the sources of deterrence coming from? And I think Rob sees it through the Slick'em End, right? Slick'em End provides that additional oomph you need in the deterrent picture and creates that additional risk that prevents the conflict. And my response is, I think the conventional forces are much more effective at getting in the heads of the adversary and also being usable. And therefore, if it's a question of, you know, this marginal increase in the nuclear force, the money is better spent elsewhere. But like that's a very like fine-grained source of disagreement, which is a fun one.
So with that, we've run a couple of minutes over here, but we appreciate you all joining us, both here in person and online, even if it was just for the free lunch. nonetheless, we appreciate taking the time, and thanks to our discussants today.
Thank you.